Okay, today is September 25th, 2015. My name is Deborah Schwartz. I am here on behalf of Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, and I'm sitting here with Larry Craig, Renaissance Man. Larry, thank you so much for sitting down with me and telling me your story, the many iterations of Larry Craig. Let us start, I think, with some just basic background about your family. Can you tell me about your people?
Yeah, I know the family on both sides goes way back into the 1800s. They've traced that in the Chicago area for my father and Ithaca, New York for my mom. And my mom and dad were both born in Chicago. They went to the University of Chicago, and they were both born in 1917. My dad was an electrical engineer. My mom had a master's in math and music, and was a music and math teacher. And she taught me piano when I was starting at four. When I was four, and we ended up with my mom had a dream of having a woodwind quintet in the family. She was a piano player and a flute player, and piccolo. And my father played French horn. And so my older sister played the bassoon, and I was the designated oboe player. Anyway, so we ended up with a woodwind quintet in the family, and my mom got to live out that fantasy. We would play for churches and for old folks' homes.
And were you born in Chicago?
I was born in Chicago.
What year were you?
In 1948.
So, and your sister's younger, older?
She's 3 years older, born in Chicago.
So your mom created literally her own quartet.
Yeah.
What is it?
And then we, let's see, in 1949, my dad built a house in Wilmette, Illinois, which is north of Chicago. Evanston is right north of Chicago, and just north of that is Wilmette. So this is a very suburbia community, very nice.
Yeah.
And just, definitely Norman Rockwell time.
Yes.
And so it was a good place to live.
Tell me the name of your parents, if you would, and your sister.
Dorothy Craig and Richard Craig.
Mm-hmm. And they were born in Chicago?
In Chicago, yeah.
And their families came from...
My mom's came from Ithaca, New York. My dad, Chicago.
Before that, though?
Yeah.
Their relatives?
Yeah.
You mean they were second generation?
They've been here for a long time. I mean, they've traced it way back. The family goes way back. And on my dad's side, somebody in our family was involved with the Douglas Lincoln debates and things like that.
Ooh, so, you're longtime Americans.
Yeah, so I said back in the 1800s. Sure.
Yeah, right, okay. Well, and so...
And originally from England, and my mom has some Danish in her too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm got some Danish. She had red hair, I had red hair when I was younger. And, I mean, reddish blonde hair and a really red beard, so...
Mm-hmm.
And so I got that. That's some Danish.
So you came from Chicago, but you live in California. What happened?
Well, I lived in Chicago. Went to 1 year at Milwaukee School of Engineering, and it was a miserable cold winter. And Milwaukee was miserable. I was miserable. I hated the school and all the people in it, and I didn't like Milwaukee and how cold it was there. Even though I was playing every weekend, I was still playing in my rock band that was back in Chicago. It was very successful. I was a bass player back then.
What's the name of the band?
It was called The Squires.
Okay.
And so what happened was late spring 1967, I came out here with a friend, and we went to the Monterey Pop Festival. And I saw that, and people that I could really relate to, and for the first time I'd experienced vibes. And I went, wow, this is for me. And so in the fall of 67, I moved here with my friend. We both, we got a house in Oakland. And next thing that happened was the spring of 68, Another friend of mine who lived in the same house found a place in Mill Valley up on Edgewood, way at the almost to the end of Edgewood in Mill Valley, and we moved in there for $90 a month for we split it three ways, and because we were really really poor at that point. And at that point I was going to College of Marin to keep my 2S draft status going.
Mm-hmm.
And well, anyway, what eventually happened was the lady that owned the house died, and I could have bought it for $8,000, but it could have been might as well have been $1 million because I had no money. I was very, very poor. And at that point, I had met Charlie Deal and started refinishing toilet seats for him.
So some people may be listening to this interview and not know who Charlie Deal is.
Charlie Deal makes toilet seat guitars, made toilet seat guitars, and that was his claim to fame. He was a local character in Mill Valley. Everybody knew Charlie. And I had been fixing guitars for myself and my friends for years since I was a kid. I went to Carnes Music in Evanston for my guitar and banjo lessons, and in the back was a little German guy named Augie that used to be a violin maker who is now a guitar repairman, and he taught me the basics of how to straighten necks and how to adjust the intonation and stuff like that. So going way back, I started working on my own instruments and my friends' instruments, not knowing it was going to become my profession. So anyway, I was really poor. My friend that moved out here with me, he met up with some people that owned the store in Berkeley called Prune Music, and actually I knew him from before. I tried out for their band Martha's Laundry, but in the meantime we got into another band in Lagunitas, which is called Rose, and we moved into the Big Brother house, which is called the Argentina house. That Teddy Roosevelt, it was his hunting lodge.
And where was that?
That was in Lagunitas at the end of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge house. And the Levi people own it now. It was a very big house. But Big Brother and the holding company had just moved out. And we knew which room was Janice's. And, it was really cool. It was a really cool place. Anyway, he got hooked up with these same people, David Kessner and Randy Smith, and who owned Prune Music in Mill Valley, in Berkeley, and they were going to open up a little tiny store in Mill Valley, extension of Prune Music. So they opened up this little store on Sunnyside. It was right now, I believe, it's a workout studio,
mm-hmm.
But it was just a tiny, tiny store.
By the bank there, Bank of Marin, was that the right there?
Yes, right there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right.
By El Paseo, cross.
Yeah, right, yeah, right, mm-hmm. Next, yeah. And it was it was split up into two at that point. One store was called Antique Telephony, and this other Mill Valley character would drive around in his old green telephone truck, and he was a hairdresser. And he's an older gentleman. All the older ladies liked him. He was very handsome. Anyway, so we had the store next to that. And Leo's Music in Oakland fronted us all their trade-in guitars that were just terrible, in terrible shape. And so, anyway, my friend Bill Steele was supposed to be working at this store. Well, right when they opened, he got into a terrible motorcycle accident and was laid up in a body cast for 6 months. So he asked if I could watch the store until he recovered. And so they said, okay. And so I was watching the store for $10 a day. And, and nobody came in. Just, it was always empty. So I was bored. So I knew how to fix guitars. So I went down the road, the line, and fixed them up one at a time, set them all up, fixed them all up, because I liked doing that, and well, Bill got better, and so in the fall of 69, they opened the new store on Locust, right off of Miller, next to what was the Brothers Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was out of a job because my friend came back, but they said, well, you've been fixing guitars, why not you turn into our guitar repairman? Because they would buy guitars down in Fresno, bring them up here, and I'd fix them all up, and then they'd sell them for, three times what they paid for them. These would be Stratocaster guitars from the 50s. You know, we'd buy them for $250 and sell them for $650. And of course, now they're worth $55,000 anyway. But that's another story. So I turned into the guitar repairman. I never thought of charging for fixing guitars. I just always enjoyed doing it. And so now all of a sudden, I was making money. So right then in the fall of 69 is when literally all the San Francisco bands moved to Marin and mainly Mill Valley. So now the bands I used to go watch at the Fillmore, I'm now working for, starting with Country Joe and then Quicksilver and Carlos. I've been working for Carlos for 46 years now. He came in 69. I worked on that red guitar he played on in the Woodstock Festival. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I've been his guitar repairman for 46 years now. Let's see. So who else? The Grateful Dead. I worked on all their stuff. The Airplane, Jefferson Airplane. That was way cool. I would go over to Paul Kantner's house, who lived on the cliff in Pacific Heights, the last house on the cliff, way to the west of the Golden Gate Bridge. And here is this beautiful house with a three-story living room with windows that went from the floor to the ceiling. And you look to the right, and that was the Golden Gate Bridge, and look to the left, and that's the ocean. And it was just an amazing place. So I'd sit there in front of these big windows, fix his guitars. About once every 2 months, I'd go there and work on everything. And who else? Big Brother. I worked for all their stuff. Well, you name it. I mean, I was working. Because this was kind of, all the other music stores were pretty much mom and pop stores, and this was like a hip store, you know, and with a infamous back room that I won't go into. But
please go into it.
Oh, it was very smoky back there.
What we're talking about, it sort of sounds a bit to me like the old barbershop place hangout. What was Prune Music like, besides just a repair shop and or sales?
Well, it wasn't a repair. It was a guitar store, mm-hmm. you know, and we had vintage guitars, and they were very cool guitars. But everybody hung out there, you know. I worked for Mike Bloomfield all through the 70s until he died, and he would hang out there a lot. Nick Gravenitis also, he loved, you know, talking to me in my shop. And Carlos Santana jamming with Mike Bloomfield, you know, things like that would happen. And all the local, this was like the meeting place for all the local musicians. They'd you know, be there, and they say, oh yeah, I haven't seen you for months, how are you doing, what have you been doing, and on and on. So this was, like you said, it was like the barbershop. And it was just an amazing place through the 70s.
And the close proximity to the 2 a.m. club, too. Yes, because I know Huey Lewis's album covers.
Oh, yeah, of course, you know. But, sure. And Huey used to come in there all the time. And, you know, Clover, everybody used to, you know, congregate there.
So you've got kind of a hangout place with your musicians that have all now transplanted from San Francisco to Mill Valley or the Marin County area.
You know, Pete Sears was in my shop yesterday. I worked for him. And he had a gig in New York today, and he had to get his bass work done. But he was in the Quicksilver and in the Starship.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I still work for him, too. I still work for Paul Kantner as well.
Uh-huh. Is he still around?
Paul Kantner?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So Prune Music is sort of, when you think of Mill Valley back in that era, I think a lot of people identify with Prune Music as a part of an era.
Yeah. Austin DeLone would be there. I mean, all the, you know, everybody was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful.
Do you have a particular memory, a particular moment that comes to mind when you think of that scene there?
Oh, just so many musicians, you know, meeting there, I suppose, would be it. One story, Neil Young came in there and looking pretty rough. I wasn't there that day, and he was looking pretty rough. He had had vocal cord surgery, and so he couldn't talk, so he was writing cards to people, and he ended up getting kicked out of the store. They didn't know who he was.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, so eventually, so Randy Smith, who was one of the owners, I eventually turned into an owner also, but Randy Smith was one of the owners. He was working for Neil Young, taking care of his amplifiers in the early 70s, and because he was our amplifier repairman. I was a guitar repairman. Randy Smith was an amplifier repairman. And he was going down to Neil's ranch down, you know, in Woodside and fixing amplifiers. Well, I guess, this was a tour in 1972. He was on the road with them, and Neil's main guitar, Old Black, had a really bad problem and wouldn't go into tune. And so Randy called me on the phone. So I fixed it with Randy's assistance. I was like the, you know, surgery by telephone. And so I fixed the guitar over the telephone and told him how to do that. And next thing you know, I'm going down to Neil's ranch with Randy. And this is in 73. And so I've been fixing Neil's guitars ever since. And one thing led to another, and then I started going on the road with Neil Young. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, for 37 years I did that.
So when you say going on the road, what do you mean going on?
I was Neil Young's guitar tech. For a while I took care of everybody's instruments on both sides of the stage, and eventually just Neil's stuff. He had quite a very complex amplifier setup, and took a lot of care and feeding every day to keep that thing going. And his guitars too, I had to go over the guitars every day to keep them in good shape, you know, restring them and really work on them to make sure they go into tune. And I was the guy in charge of all the gear.
So you're the guitar doctor.
I was Neil's, you know, stage tech. I was a guy that tuned the guitars and handed them to him. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another, and I got, you know, I play a lot of different instruments. So I was like the utility guy when Neil needed a piano player, an organ player, a pedal steel player, banjo player. You know, every time he played Old Man live, I was the banjo player. And it was wonderful. It was a great thing to do. He had this band called the Blue Notes, Neil Young and the Blue Notes, in the late 80s. This note's for you. I was a baritone sax player in that band. And thank God I played the oboe, because Neil asked me, do you play saxophone? We were in Germany somewhere, and he needed an alto sax player in the band for this one song. I said, oh yeah, I've never touched a saxophone in my life. And this has happened a lot with him, where I always say yes, you know, and if I'd bitten off more than I could chew. So they rented me a saxophone, which I own now still. Very nice Selmer Mark VI. Anyway, that night I was playing in the band, just this one song, but I was actually playing because I could transfer the oboe over to the saxophone, and it worked great. It really did. And the same thing happened with the baritone sax as well. So with the Blue Notes, we had the song called This Note's for You, and it was a great, great video, hilarious video. You should look it up on YouTube if you get a chance. But it was got very, very high rotation on MTV, which was huge at the time. Mm-hmm. And for 2 weeks, and then the lawyers for MTV shut us down. They said, you can't play this on MTV anymore, because what it was putting down their advertisers that had, Eric Clapton coming out for Miller and Michael Jackson coming out for Coke. Mm-hmm. And so there's these parodies, these skits, all the way through this video. So we were banned from MTV, and you never guess who won the video of the year that year for MTV.
No.
This Note's for You. Anyway, so that was another life. Anyhow, so where were
so
we?
So we've got a couple iterations. Music. Yeah, prune music, but you're really very notorious for another kind of wave. On the mountain, the mountain biking.
Oh, yeah, sure. So I what happened is I moved up to Ukiah. This is another story, but lived on the land with my ex-wife, now ex-wife, and her brother and his girlfriend and her daughter, 8 miles in from 101 on the McNabb Ranch. And
what year is this?
This would be the fall of 71, I believe. And here I'm still working at Prune Music, which is I'll tell you how that worked. But anyway,
yeah.
We had an Army 6x6. We loaded all our stuff to it. I'd never been there before. We loaded everything we had, drove up to on top of this hill where my brother-in-law at this point had bought 20 acres, but it might as well have been thousands because there was nobody to the west of us at all, and our closest neighbor to the towards 101 was 5 miles in. So we were out there all by ourselves in the middle of nowhere, and so we built a dome because the winter was coming. And
no house either.
There was nothing. There was no outhouse. There was no water. There was no nothing. And so we luckily you could buy the redwood sapwood for $40 a thousand board feet, the reject wood, because up in Ukiah at that point the atmosphere was always smoky because there are these lumber mills and they would smolder their chips, and it was just terrible up there, you know, in the valley, not where we were, but in the valley of Ukiah. And anyway, they had all this extra wood that they didn't know what to do, so we loaded up the big 6x6, which is an Army vehicle from World War II, and we built ourselves a dome and then another building next to it, and that's where we were for a few years. But I had a Volkswagen that I would drive in the middle of the winter. It was supposed to be year-round roads, but it got so muddy up there that the roads weren't any good, so I had a Volkswagen and put snow tires on it, and if I got going fast enough, I could make it by the muddy parts, and I could make it all the way back and go down to Prune Music, and I would commute for a while. It was a two-hour each direction commute, and then sometimes I'd spend a few days with my friend Bill Steele, who lived in San Anselmo, who worked at Prune Music.
Mm-hmm.
He was an owner at Prune Music as well. So
in a VW, like
in
a little
Volkswagen
bug?
Yeah.
So you were in one of those little bugs?
Yeah, and I learned how to, the engine would blow up, and I learned how to, here I was up in Ukiah, and I was able to pull the motor myself by, I had a stump, and I had a 2x8, and I would sit on the 2x8 and pull on the, undo the four bolts, pull on the exhaust pipes, and the engine would come down, and I knew how. I'd already rebuilt a couple of Volkswagen engines already, so, you know, in the mud was not the best of circumstances, but I was so poor, I had to either rebuild it, or I wouldn't have any vehicle, and so...
But why did you go to Ukiah, though? You're working, you've got jobs.
I had nowhere to live. I was, oh, here comes my...
okay, let's take a pause
yeah.
here. Hang on a second. Yes.
So, you know, why would I go to Ukiah? It was way cool. It was a way cool thing to do. You get up there, and it takes a while to come down from the big city, meaning Mill Valley, which at that point was a pretty big city compared to having nobody there. The closest neighbor, 5 miles, or the other direction, 20 miles.
Yeah.
And couldn't hear anything. And no lights at night. You couldn't see any lights anywhere because we were up on a hill and you could see this whole valley. Nobody was there. It's changed now, but...
So you were, what was Mill Valley like at that time when you left it? What was the, can you describe the ambiance of Mill Valley?
Yeah, at 8 o'clock, they rolled up the sidewalks.
8 p.m.
Yep, that was the end of it. And of course, the old mill and the brothers and the 2 a.m. club were open, and you couldn't buy gas. That was a problem. All the gas stations closed. And of course, you know, there were no... you know, open supermarkets or anything like that. So you could buy a beer at the bar, but you couldn't buy gas. And 8 o'clock, that was it. It just, the town shut down, well, long before that, but 8 o'clock, nothing was open. And it was a different place. I knew all the musicians, and everybody knew everybody, and it was a much smaller town then. That's what I felt.
Yeah. So you're commuting back and forth from Ukiah, but at some point you started getting involved with the mountain biking.
Yes, I did. I ended up buying a house very, very inexpensively on top of a hill in Fairfax, and my next door neighbor, his name was Fred Wolf. and he was one of the original mountain bikers. He was good friends with Charlie Kelly. Yeah, mm-hmm. And he was. So he got into modifying these old Schwinn bicycles and taught me how to do it, and so I started doing it. And I actually had the guy at Mill Valley Cyclery, John was his name, and Cesar, who was his helper, he would build up these bicycles. They were old Schwinn bicycles, and I put special cranks and front derailleurs and a rear derailleur. And I was the first guy to have a smaller front gear than my largest back gear, so I had lower than 1-to-1 ratio. And they didn't make a front sprocket very small at that point. So this was a one I took off of a Stingray bike, a little 20-inch bicycle, and it was too fat for a derailleur chain, so I ground it down on a belt sander and used that. And so I had, I could spin up the hills, have very, very low gears. Of course, some of my friends were still riding one speeds, and they just gave me all kinds of, they thought I was a wimp for having such a low gear. Of course, now mountain bikes have those low gears.
What year are we talking here?
74, 75.
So you went from Ukiah back over here?
To Fairfax.
Okay, yeah.
And, of course, up on top of this hill, I was just, about 4 minutes away from Camp Tamarancho, which is the big Boy Scout camp on the Marin watershed area. And that's where I'd go bicycling. We called it clunking at the time. The word mountain bike hadn't been coined yet, so we went clunking.
Who coined clunking?
I don't know, because they were clunkers. And so, do you want to go on a clunk, is what Fred Wolf would tell me. And so we'd go on a clunk. And there were no mountain bikes then. So anyway, Joe Breeze, there's a couple of versions of the story, but anyway, he was going to make some mountain bikes. And so I fronted him a lot of money to so he could buy the tubing. I know Charlie also did that, but so we both did that. And so out of that, I got two of the original mountain bikes. I think he made 10.
Oh, you didn't Charlie give money to Joe for a bike, and then you also?
I did it also, for two. Mm-hmm. So I gave him a lot of money at that point, which was,
How much was it then?
I can't remember, mm-hmm. but it was, pennies on the dollar, because that bicycle, there's, one of those is in the Smithsonian now. Mm-hmm. And my ex-wife, Wendy, had one, and I had one.
And so she was a rider, too.
Eventually, she got into it. She wasn't into bikes at all at the beginning, but eventually, I made her a clunker. It was a black one, I think, a Murray. Anyway, so she got into it, too. And she'd go on these rides with everybody. And,
So you were an athlete.
I don't know if I was an athlete, but, we had this race called Repack, which was in, ended up in the Cascades in Fairfax. And we go up to the top of the hill over the Meadow Club at the tip top of the hill there and go right up this fire trail. And we, had timed races where you, synchronize the clocks and send riders off one at a time. Well, I was at the first one, and at this one corner called Camera Corner, there was a branch sticking off to the right, and it hooked my right arm and turned my handlebars quickly, and I went flying over the handlebars, and it just rung my bell. I think I got a concussion, but for the rest of the week, I was trying to fix guitars, and I was kind of dingy, and so that was my last Repack race that I rode. After then, I was a photographer, right? Because I've been a photographer my whole life. My dad had a dark room in the basement, so, he taught me about photography. So I've always been a photographer. So I decided to, I had this Nikon camera I got in Japan when I was there with Neil in 76. So I had this camera, really good camera, and I started taking pictures at this one corner, which eventually called was called Camera Corner because I was there. And the reason I was there is because there's a sharp corner, a sharp left-hand corner, and bikes would kick up a lot of dust and a lot of gravel and make a good picture. Otherwise, my camera would freeze them, mm-hmm. and you couldn't tell that they were moving at all. So this was the one corner that you could really tell, and I would go over the edge of the corner a little bit, so I was, in a very good position for good photography. So most of the pictures you see about the early days of clunking and repack are mine.
In Charlie Kelly's book?
Yeah, most of those are mine too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get credit for a few of them. Unfortunately, my ex-wife usurped a lot of my photos, and we're working that out to try to put the proper name on the photos. She used to call it courtesy Wendy Craig, and now the photos are by Wendy Craig, and she wasn't even there for a few of the years, but that's another story. But most of them really were taken by me on repack. I will say that on the repack photos I took most of. I took some other photos of Wendy up in the Sierras, and they made it into Bicycling Magazine and some posters for Bicycling Magazine, and mm-hmm. So that was some of the first mountain biking photos. The first ones were an Outside, it was called Outside Mariah. It was a combination of two magazines, Mariah and Outside, and they made it into that in the very early 80s, I believe, and also Bicycling Magazine.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so you've been, just keep coming up with new things here.
Yeah.
Have you been to the new bike museum?
Yes, I have. And I saw a couple of photos I took. Unfortunately, my name's not under them. My ex-wife's name. So I'm working this out. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. But I think good for Joe is what I say, because mm-hmm. someone had to do it. It used to be in Colorado. And so I guess Crested Butte. And mm-hmm. and now it's here.
Well, there was a race in Crested Butte. Were you there?
Yeah. No, I was not. Mm-hmm. No. But so it's appropriate for it to be in Fairfax, I believe, because I think back then there was various groups of clunkers. There was some in, Corte Madera, and there was some in Mill Valley, and some in Fairfax. And most of the people, I think most of us were in Fairfax, but you pretty much knew everybody that had a clunker. There was not very many of us. I'd say 20 total. Mm-hmm. And, riding our built-up Schwinns or not built-up Schwinns, one-speed ones. Most of the guys in, I think, Corte Madera, they stuck to their one-speeds. Reason Repack was called Repack, the race, is because on the one-speed bikes, they had the coaster brake, and you backpedal to brake. Well, by the time you got to the bottom, you'd have to repack the hub, which had the brake in it, because all the grease had been,
exhausted
on the way down, because you were braking so hard. So that's why it was called repack.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the word.
So can you give me some names of your friends that you were riding with, just to help us to imagine who?
Well, you've talked to most of the people, Charlie, of course, and Fred Wolf, he shouldn't be forgotten. He was certainly one of the main people that would go on clunks with you.
Mm-hmm. More names? Can you think of any other names?
Oh, I can't right now. But, mm-hmm. It's all the same guys, though, mm-hmm. that you see on that clunking movie. And Lee Michaels, I got him involved. Who else? A couple other. Craig Chiquiso from the Starship. I got him involved. And Lee Michaels, who ended up buying Prune Music from me. Who was a pretty famous organ player, musician at that time. Mm-hmm. And I got him into it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember Bobby Weir on his mountain bike, mm-hmm. When we lived down the street. I think you got some other musicians.
Yeah, him too, sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He used to come and hang out in my guitar repair shop. He would spend a lot of time back there, actually. Mm-hmm. And we just, he was a great guy. Mm-hmm. But I haven't had any contact with him lately.
Mm-hmm. So after the repack era, then you continued to be working on your guitars. That's been a steady theme in your...
Yeah, Prune Music closed in 1985, and I built a shop here on my property in 1985. And
Here in San Anselmo.
Here in San Anselmo, right on center in Madrone. It's been working out very well because now I had no overhead. Before, my overhead, either I owned the store or I would fix the store's guitars for free, and they would take in the guitars for me in the front counter, and that took care of my overhead for my rent too. So mm-hmm. that's how I worked back then after mm-hmm. I sold the store.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked out much better having my own place, and then I didn't have to keep hours or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And you...
So I still fix guitars.
Yeah. So when you look back at your time here in Marin County, and can you describe what this area has given to you, what you've experienced, how it's formed you?
Well, I would say... learning that most of Marin is not built up. So when you go on these mountain bike rides is what you call it now, but you get back in the woods and you realize that most of Marin is just watershed, and it's just down in the valleys that it looks so built up and the traffic's terrible and there's so many houses, but it's not like that. If you go to the top of Mount Tam and look out, most of Marin is not built up. And it's just down in the valleys, you see all the houses, but when you're on a mountain bike, you know, cruising in the back, you know, on the hills and the ridges, you realize there's most of it's pristine.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. I mean, I love nature.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that when you compare it to your early childhood in Chicago, could you have imagined that you would have been heading in I mean, Evanston's a lovely, suburban, beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the difference? Can you describe
it? As soon as I got out here, I never looked back. I thought it was so much nicer here. I never wanted to go back. I don't miss the winters at all. I don't miss the muggy, hot summers. And by the time I left that area, my family had moved to Winnetka, and we lived on Sheridan Road in Winnetka, which was the number one street right by the lake there, and nothing but, you know, mansions on this, and to leave that area, really highly stuck up, very straight area, and to come out here and have the people so completely different and so much easier to get along with. I never looked back. I sure never wanted to go back.
When you talk about the people of this area, how would you describe in your time, in your experiences, what the people have been like for you?
Well, back then I would have been described as a hippie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, dope smoking hippie, I suppose, you know. And so when I was up in Ukiah, they didn't like hippies up there at all. And so the police would harass us, and we bought chickens, you know, little tiny chicks, and they thought they'd play a joke on us. They were all sexed, but it turns out we got 25 roosters, not 25 chickens. Ha ha ha.
Oh, and, my gosh.
And we didn't know that, and pretty soon they make these funny sounds as they're growing up, and then finally they're turning into roosters, and we're finally realizing, oh, they're all roosters, so they're fighting, and
yeah,
oh, my
aggressive.
God. Anyway. But even down here, though, the police did not like hippies, and they would, you know, really harass you. And mm-hmm. But there are also a lot of, you know, hip people down here, and this is, a really good area for them, and we all knew each other, and it was like, you know, smoking pot was like the sacrament. We all got together and smoked a joint, and a lot of that went on here.
Mm-hmm. And you've also, what's interesting is when you're talking about the music too, you've really been a witness and a participant in an era of music that is.
Oh yeah, you know, to been working on all the instruments of all these famous bands at the time. I was, I was, I loved it, you know, and to tour with Neil Young for so many years, and with Nils Lofgren as well. It was really quite an experience for me.
Yeah. Well, in closing, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. Well, actually, just one question. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we haven't talked about today that you would like to say? Anything at all?
Well, there's Vintage Instrument Rental. It's a company I own. And we have literally hundreds of vintage guitars and, you know, almost that many amplifiers. And I don't rent them nearly as much as I used to because the studio scene is pretty much dead. But I used to go down to the plant at least twice a week, sometimes three times a week.
In Sausalito,
the record plant, and deliver instruments and amplifiers to various bands. And it worked out very well for me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've rented Neil Young many, you know, like most of the backline gear on some of the tours. And I toured with his wife, Peggy Young, for many years. And I, same deal, I rented almost, except for the drums, I rented all the backline gear to them on for the whole tour, so that worked out very well for me.
And you're still doing that?
I still am doing that, yeah.
Yeah.
And also I'm playing in a band now that I'm not touring with Neil anymore. It's called Buck Nichols and Loose Change. I'm a pedal steel player now, and we have a CD out now, but as of today, our second CD is being made right now. And I play pedal steel, and then I play a lot of organ on it, and piano, and three saxophones, and trumpet, and dobro, and a few other things on this. And it's wonderful. It's a great album, great CD. Buck Nichols, Loose Change, Black Point Cutoff is the name of the album.
Great. I look forward to hearing it. Well, yeah. I just want to say, Larry, thank you so much for sharing your many iterations, your many lives, your many me's, and all your adventures that you were so wonderfully described. Thank you for bringing to us a Mill Valley of an era that many missed, or, you know, maybe been born too late to imagine. But it is a part of Mill Valley that I think is an important part to remember. So thank you for sharing that
and
all your clunking stories.
Yeah.
Everything. Thanks so much for sharing your life.
Okay.
All right. That's it. Okay. So now back here with Larry Craig, and we're going to add on a little bit more about Charlie.
Yeah. Back in 1969, when I was minding the store in downtown Mill Valley on Sunnyside, Charlie Deal, of course, would come in, and he was making these toilet seat guitars. He's famous for it. That was his claim to fame, as he made the toilet seat guitars. And you can see one on the cover of Sports that's hanging on the wall of the 2 AM Club in the Huey Lewis album. So in the early days, I was very poor, so Charlie got me, you know, Charlie was very into finding genuine wood toilet seats to make his guitars out of. And so that, in a way, was my first paid guitar repair gig, was refinishing toilet seats for Charlie. And I can't believe it, but that's how it was. And he would find all the parts and, you know, sort of put them together, but I would, you know, put the pickups on them and put the bridge on them and you know, make them a playable guitar. So I would actually make it into a guitar you could play, because he didn't quite understand where the bridge goes or how it goes, or how to put the pickup on it and wire it up. So I did all that. So I kind of turned it into an actual guitar.
So may I ask, because Charlie's not here, unfortunately, to speak for himself, but where did his inspiration come from to make the toilet seat?
I don't know. You know, he was way into it. He was into it before, you know, we had Prune Music. He was, you know, he'd been doing this. I don't know what. Of course, he had also, besides the guitar, he had a bass, and he would call the four flusher. He would just he would love saying that. You know, Charlie would say the same jokes over and over again, but that was one of his favorites, things to say. Everybody knew Charlie.
Oh, I'm sorry we didn't get an interview with him.
Yeah, that's it.